Lana Odoms of the Louisiana ACLU. We want to end back with Albert Woodfox. Albert, right now, people are being told to remain in isolation, whether they're sick or healthy, unless they get so sick that they should go to a hospital. I mean, there is no comparison to what you endured. You served more time in solitary confinement than any prisoner in the United States, close to 44 years. But can you talk about how you kept your sanity when you were behind bars in solitary?
Robert Gilbert King and Harmer Wallace, the other two members of Makeup Angels, by any stretch of the imagination, our situation was extraordinary. The fact that we were, had, become members of the Black Panther Party, we had been politicized. We had our political and social consciousness, level of consciousness raised, so we kind of like understood the purpose of solitary, what it was meant to do. And so we consciously, together and individually, developed programs to combat that, for such as exercise programs, study programs, in which we devoted so many hours a day to just reading, and not just sit in a cell for 23 hours out of 24-hour period and vegetate, become consumed by the prison culture, all the other distractions that was given to solitary over decades, such as CDs and radios and CD players and stuff like that, And the fact that we were looked upon as leaders in the prison population, demanded of us that, we prepare ourselves by by educating ourselves and knowing that, whatever subject matter that was brought to our attention, that we would be adequately informed enough to address it. A solitary, a surviving solitary is an individual thing, it's still a mystery why, men, women, in some cases children, react to the same condition differently, Robin and I was talking the other day, and Robin has a saying: when somebody throws you lemons, you make lemonade, And so we have been talking because we knew at some point in time this will pass. And one of the questions we are asked the most when we go around the country and outside the country is, where is the lack to be held in solitary, And so, we never had a reference other than our own experience. But this coronavirus pandemic, now people have a small window into what it's like to be held in, with the advice of the CDC and other federal agencies.
Albert,
and state agencies.
We have to go, but I want to thank you so much for being with us. And I want to encourage people to go to our website at democracynow.org. We had you in studio for an hour talking about your experience just after you got out of prison. That book, truly remarkable, a National Book Award finalist, Solitary, Unbroken by Four Decades in Solitary Confinement, My Story of Transformation and Hope. Albert Woodfox speaking to us from New Orleans. He served the longest time in solitary confinement of any prisoner in the United States.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, KBOO will be sticking to our regularly scheduled programming as much as possible, but there are some limitations that we're working with, so we appreciate your understanding and support. We are committed to keeping our staff, volunteers, and programmers safe and healthy, so we are transitioning to producing programs remotely. For updates on KBOO's response to the COVID-19 pandemic, visit our website at kboo.fm/COVID-19. That's kboo.fm/COVID-19.
The time is 3 minutes after 8 a.m. here on this Wednesday morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and it is time for Wednesday Talk Radio, and here are your hosts, Paul and Jackie.
Good morning. This is Paul. Hi, Jackie.
Yes, good morning.
And Jacqueline, of course, is our regular second Wednesday co-host here on the Wednesday Talk Radio show. And she is a Yankton Dakota and Navajo or Diné, a native woman who is a local writer. And we'll be talking about COVID's impact in Indian country, among many other things, and also about your new podcast show, Pollen Nation, which is really exciting. But first, you're not just native, you're a human being facing this incredibly, situation, like we all are, and struggling, you know, to relate to your surroundings, the what's happening to the economy, and I just want to ask you let's talk a little bit about your thoughts about what's happening, how this country is dealing with it, what you're seeing in your own community.
Yeah, so, in January I was I traveled across the Navajo Nation on assignment, and in the fall I was going a lot to my dad's reservation on the Yankton Sioux Reservation in South Dakota, covering the flooding there, and so I've been touching bases back with folks that I had interviewed during my travels, and of course, the landscape, the communities on my respective homeland, my parents' tribes, are very much on my mind. And so I've been really touching bases and keeping track of how people are doing. Of course, on the Yankton Sioux Reservation, the families I interviewed had been dealing with flooding of their homes for a year now, since last March, over a year now, and standing water and children getting, MRSA and stuff from contact with E. coli in their homes.
Is that still going on?
Yes, it's still going on.
Wow.
In the midst of all this, yeah. And one of the first coronavirus cases, confirmed cases, was of a Yankton Sioux man from my dad's tribe in Indian Country. And the first case in Indian Country was on my dad's reservation. And so I immediately contacted folks I had interviewed, families living in that housing, the flooded housing, and it turned out he'd worked for the tribe, and they had been in contact with all of them because he works particularly with the housing.
Oh, God.
And so many of them were given 14-day quarantine. So I kept in touch with them while they were going through the quarantine. And actually, last Friday, with the podcast series, and we're doing, I'm the Pollen Nation magazine, which is a new news magazine which covers Indian Country. And so we've been doing this podcast series about coronavirus in Indian Country and how communities and leaders and activists are dealing with it. And so last Friday, we did an episode on the housing situation, and so that was it's pretty scary. I mean, luckily the families I was in contact with, they didn't have any more cases of coronavirus come out of that contact with him, and so they were able to leave their quarantine. And then of course on the Navajo Nation, I've been following in talking to communities across the Navajo Nation, folks from those communities I've interviewed in the past, and Valley members, of course. And actually, one of my a couple of my cousins were featured in an LA Times article that came out recently, I think just last week, about how the Navajo Nation is dealing with it. And so,
It's hitting pretty hard there, right?
Well, the thing is, like, so the article in the LA Times was called "No Running Water, No Electricity on Navajo Nation: Coronavirus Creates Worry and Confusion as Cases Surge." And I had referred the reporter to actually some of my family members, and he actually reads the article by talking to my younger cousin Lisa Robbins, and about, you know, her mother has had serious surgery. She herself was born without a thyroid, probably because of the uranium mining that's been going on there since World War II, and so they have pre-existing conditions. And on top of that, you know, the issue of having running water, you know, being able to wash your hands regularly, and these are communities where, you know, the running water is not extensive. There's not. I know it's hard for. It's sort of, you know, I grew up going home and, you know, seeing my grandparents live, you know, without electricity, you know, using kerosene lamps. And then also, you know, they had a propane tank that was filled for their cooking, but for heating they used wood, and then no running water. They'd have to truck water in these giant containers, plastic containers, barrels, and, you know, they would either go to Tuba City or they would drive all the way to Flagstaff, which is about 40 minutes, almost an hour away, and refill them. And just, you know, fill it back of a pickup truck full of these giant, and this is what they used for water, using a hose to siphon it out, you know. and you know, I think, and to this day, you know, it's better. Some houses have running water now. My grandmother worked really hard on that. All her later years, she advocated for that, but many don't. And the roads are not good. The piece I was reporting on was about the voting issues, and part of that is that, you know, there aren't great roads, there isn't great mail service, there, you know, a lot of dirt roads, so yeah, it's pretty scary. And then, of course, not a lot of shopping, grocery stores. I mean, the reservation is the size of Ireland, right? And so I think there are 14 grocery stores on the entire reservation, you know. And so it extends over three states. So, but the numbers coming out of there you know, it has to be taken in a certain context, because the Navajo Nation is doing far more testing than the state of Arizona. I saw a recent article where they were comparing the two, and a reporter, and he was making claims that, you know, Navajos were just far more susceptible and much higher rates, but he wasn't actually talking about rates, he was talking about total numbers. And the issue is that the Navajo Nation is doing coronavirus testing of four times the amount of their population the state of Arizona has.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, they're doing far more testing, so when you do more testing, you get more numbers.
Right.
When I did the math last time, they had done about 1.4% of their population on the Navajo Nation. I mean, this is the resident population, not the entire tribe, because only about 50% of the tribe lives on the reservation. So you're talking about 175,000 people, right? And the numbers they're giving out are also of non-tribal citizens who live on the reservation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they've tested, I think it's even more now with the latest update I got today, but they've tested well over probably 1.5% of their population, but the state of Arizona has only tested 0.3%. So it's hard to compare the two because Arizona's numbers are so less complete. Uh-huh. And I think that this sort of is, to me, an expression of some of the strengths that I see in Navajo culture. And Navajo culture is not American culture per se. It's you know, I think you see the Bundys out there now, ready to arm up and defend the right of anyone to defy the quarantine. right?
Yeah, well, let's talk about that a little bit for sure later.
But in the Navajo way, you know, I think there is this concept of community, of relationship. I mean, when you introduce yourself in Navajo, you know, you introduce yourself by giving your clan, each of the clans of your grandparents, of all four of your grandparents, and your clan you carry is your maternal clan, is the one that comes from your maternal grandmother. That's your clan. We're matrilineal. And so when I introduce myself in Navajo, I have to begin by giving my clan. And this tells other people how they're related to me and what their kinship obligation is to me, like how they're supposed to behave towards me. And
so I guess what you're saying is the mutual aid that the rest of us are having to sort of relearn in the midst of crisis is something that's sort of inherent to your culture.
Yeah, so I think it elicits a different response. I mean, there's more social cohesiveness.
Right.
One of my cousins, she was also featured in the Los Angeles Times article, and she was saying, she posted recently, which I actually read during on Monday, we interviewed the former Navajo Attorney General on our podcast, and about the fundraiser she's been doing for Navajo and Hopi communities on the reservations, so to bring them supplies during the stay-at-home order, I read it then, and so my cousin was talking about how hard it is to keep her mom at home, to tell elders that they need to stay home, because there is also this element of real independence. I think, watching YouTube videos on, my grandmother was a traditional Navajo, and so were, you know, my grandfather's siblings all lived in the area, and they were all traditional elders, and so I grew up seeing many traditional elders. I mean, I would say when we were left on the ranch, the majority of the people were elders who spoke only Navajo and lived traditionally, and, you know, were herding sheep and raising cattle and, growing orchards, you know, with peaches and apricots and all these things that they were doing, you know. And to me, seeing that, it was obviously, you know, now that I'm older, I realize, like, the independence that Navajo people have, and the independence of Navajo women, because, of course, all of those things belong to them in traditional culture. So they have a certain, the way they address things is based in a sense of being, because we're matrilineal and things are based on the clan, women have an incredible sense of, I don't know how to put it, entitlement, I guess, you know, and authority. Not authority, it's really hard to, it's very distinct. And so I feel really lucky to have been raised with those examples of womanhood in my life. And I realize as I get older the extent to which they have formed me and made me, and just having that example as a counter to sort of white materialism and sort of the advertising ideal of white womanhood. You know, I was very fortunate to have a much more stronger a comprehensive idea of being a woman in a culture that supports that in many ways. And mm-hmm. So I think that comes out at times like this, but, you know, if, you know, an elderly woman who's used to running her own life and having her sheep and having her own money and having her own, being an authority in her family, it's sort of hard to tell her, like, no, you have to stay home. Can't go shopping because you're at risk. Do you know what I mean?
Let's talk a little more about the in general the impact of COVID in Indian country. What you're saying about the Navajo situation being important to put in context, but there's also, it's coming out more and more and more how brutally disproportionate the impacts, racial and economic impacts of the COVID are. It's just shocking how, you know, up to 70% or more of some inner city populations like Detroit and Chicago of the deaths are actually from African Americans. And obviously, you know, nationwide, the health disparities in Indian country are real. There's, you know, diabetes, heart disease, asthma, and such. So this, you know, there's obviously, it's, I don't think there's probably a lot of, it's just really emerging in Indian country. We don't see a lot of talk yet about the impacts in rural America in general, because so much of it has been, you know, New York, California, and major population centers. But it is starting to hit. So you must be concerned about the impact that it's starting to have and will have on Indian country.
Yeah, definitely. I think, although I have been lately sort of taking an issue with, I feel like some of the reporting, that's done by non-native journalists about the issue tends to be very exploitive and very, it's sort of on the line of the usual approach to covering Indian country is poverty porn, you know. Mm-hmm. And that sort of reporting is incredibly disempowering to Native people. And it's not done, I don't think 90% of the time it's not done purposefully, but it's done unconsciously because of the way that most Americans are taught to relate to Indian people, or they have so little knowledge of Indian people that these stereotypes are their only construct they have to understand what's going on and to report within that construct, mm-hmm. you know. And so what I think we are, the podcast that we're doing through Pollination Magazine, we're doing three times a week because there is so little, you know, there is so much need for that level of reporting and diversity of topics. So
talk a little bit about how you got that started and who's working on that and when it started, the podcast.
Yeah. So it started... I guess we're now on our sixth show, today, which we're going to be actually focusing on. So we started it, I guess. what's the date on that one? I think March 27th on a mm-hmm. Friday. And the first episode, I just did an overview, to catch people up to what's been happening in the country with coronavirus, and also what's been happening nationally, internationally. And then the second and third episodes we started bringing guests in, we looked at the legal aspect of coronavirus, and we had interviewed different things, looking at the issue of stay-at-home orders and tribes and this week we, as I mentioned, we had the Monday's episode was about mutual aid, and so we looked at that and we focused on the GoFundMe, the Hopi Navajo COVID-19 relief GoFundMe started by Ethel Branch, the former Attorney General of the Navajo Nation. And today we're looking actually at the Indian Child Welfare Act and the impact of stay-at-home orders on parental rights and child safety. Mm-hmm. We're interviewing Angela Bibbins, who is an Indian Child Welfare Act. She's an attorney that focuses on cases like that in Colorado with Native families, and also a Lakota attorney from Rapid City who's run for mayor of Rapid City this past year, Natalie Stites, and she's an advocate in the foster care system, and actually sits on a number of really important boards administering it in South Dakota, dealing with Native communities. And so some of the concerns that are coming up from that is that, Native parents, there may be a glut of Native parents losing their rights in the next few months, their parental rights.
And why is that?
Because they're unable to meet the court-mandated requirements to get back on track to regaining custody of their children, whether it's checkups or rehab programs, all of these things, the ability to maintain those aspects.
I was just listening to NPR earlier in there yesterday, I think, and they're asking someone the question, well, what do you think some of the Actually, no, it wasn't. Anyway, it was another radio station. But they're asking the guest what some of the lesser the less obvious impacts of this are. And they're actually talking about people, you know, they couldn't imagine trying to go through rehab or dealing with, you know, the consequences of you know, being being in a situation of dealing with a, you know, in an institutional setting or having to report stuff like that. There must be innumerable situations where people are faced with really difficult choices. Like you can't get to the place you have to report, like reporting to your parole officer, or in this case, you know, dealing with the, you know, the bureaucracy of the ICWA.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, and also the other aspect of it is the issue of foster care. Native children are far more likely to be placed in foster care for a number of reasons, many of them, you know, basically racism, and the result of historical injustice. Some of the foster families, you know, that the attorney we're speaking to have actually come down with coronavirus.
Oh, God.
So the children can't be placed there. So they have to, so they're trying to find other places to place them. There really aren't any other places. There's always a shortage. And then also the issue of checkups, like how do social workers go and do checkups? And she was having, she was telling me that she was having one of her, the young men, a boy who was in placement, he would come out halfway and then they could do a visual checkup from the car, the social worker could, and stuff. So it does impede a lot of these different aspects. So, you know, Native people have been, this has been part of the assault on our identity is the removal and taking of children and the breaking up of families so that, you know, cultural things can't be passed down, right? So, you know, the old saying of, you know, kill the Indian and save the man, you know? And so so we wind up with a huge percentage of Native children being removed. When the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed through Congress in 1977, that was after a congressional report found that between 25 and 35% of Native children were being removed from their homes. And so that falls within the parameters of the Geneva Convention on Genocide, because that's one of the ways you commit genocide is the taking of children from ethnic groups, you know, it's from ethnic ethnic cleansing, I guess, you know.
Let me just remind our listeners, this is a Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the regular weekly host, Paul Rowland, and also on the telephone from her own home is Jacqueline Keeler, who's the second Wednesday co-host. We focus on issues impacting Native Americans, otherwise known as Indian country. And she is started the Pollen Nation magazine along with some of her colleagues, and that branched out into a tandem project, which is the Pollination podcast, and we're talking about that. And I've linked to your the Pollination magazine on my page. It's actually pollinationmagazine.org, I believe, .com. So www.pollination.com. And I've also linked to that on our KBOO.FM Wednesday Talk Radio page. And this is a call-in show. We're already almost halfway through, but the number to call to get on the show is 503-231-8187. And so you mentioned your last show on Monday was about mutual aid. I want to talk a little bit more about some of the projects that are developing around that.
Yeah, well, this episode pretty much on, you know, really on the one GoFundMe, interviewing one person. Often our shows will have, you know, we've had up to three or four guests, but usually two guests is usually how many we have. But yeah, we really focused on that single. But there are many different things going on, and there will be more. I know that my family are working on doing some activities in Cameron, Arizona, and the White Swan Housing on the Incan Sioux Reservation is looking at doing more fundraising. And so there are many different ones out there, and we can definitely put a list together at Pollination Magazine. But this one, this particular fundraiser has raised over $400,000.
Wow.
And they've done several runs of trailers, they haven't actually been able to access any of that money yet. So the mostly Navajo and Hopi volunteers have been paying for these trailers of food and things out of their own pocket. And but they've had to disinfect everything. They're very careful about how they bring it into the communities because, of course, they don't want to infect them with the virus. Ethel Branch, who's the former Navajo Attorney General and an attorney in Flagstaff, her partner is Hopi. And so that's why the focus is on Navajos and Hopis working together at this time. And so they've done runs up to Molenkopi and to other Hopi villages and on the Navajo Nation. And the Hopi tribe are particularly in a vulnerable position because, of course, they lost 80% of their tribal income when the coal plants shut down, which, of course, is great for the environment, but it's been a financial hardship for the tribe.
Yeah, I mean, like all localities, cities, states are all strapped and trying to find the resources to deal with this pandemic, and obviously Indian country is faced with the same thing. And you want to talk a little bit about, from what I understand, that with that big multi-trillion-dollar package to deal with the crisis, which ended up bailing out also, as usual, a lot of corporations. But from my understanding, Trump didn't even want to have any money in there for Native Americans. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, they actually, it's one of the things that held it up was the fact they didn't want money to go to Native people, to Native tribes.
So people actually had to fight to insert that in there?
Yeah, jeez. Yeah, they did.
Oh my God.
They had to fight to get that in there, and the small businesses, the SBA loans, they recently issued instructions last week saying that it can't go to gaming.
Huh.
So all that money that was those SBA loans is hundreds of billions of dollars. Right now, as it stands, the tribes that have casinos that have been shuttered can't actually access any of those funds.
And of course, those are major economic engines for a lot of tribes, which maybe we have to sort of reiterate. A lot of people don't really understand that. There's a lot of misunderstanding about the casinos and gaming in Indian country, but obviously, if one has an understanding of how badly or little a lot of the treaty obligations were lived up to in terms of providing the infrastructure and other needs for the tribes in compensation for the millions and millions of acres that were given up. The casinos are like a small recompense, but a really crucial one for a lot of tribes, right?
Yeah. In fact, I think I saw a figure where one-fifth of the economy revolves around it. So it's a huge engine. It's money that's very almost impossible to replace. I mean, and it goes to fund a lot of important things. Like at Sandy Rock, when that was going on, the standoff was going on there at Sandy Rock, the state of North Dakota basically did a roadblock blocking entrance onto the reservation, and it reduced the casino income, which I think was around $8 million a year, to just a couple million, which meant that the tribe had millions of dollars that they had no replacement for. And those funds go to fund, heating for elders in the winter, all kinds of social service money that are very difficult to obtain otherwise. And so it did mean that they had to cut more programs. That money has never returned to that level again.
I see on Friday you're going to be talking more broadly about how the Trump administration is using COVID-19 as cover to plunder tribal resources. Before we get into that, it just seems like, I mean, it's almost useless. It's interesting on the major media how people are starting to say, well, listen, don't even expect anything from this man who's occupying the office of the presidency at this point. People are, you know, but you still do have to unfortunately take into account. And one thing of his personal sociopathy or whatever his psychology is he has this thing based upon his own interests in casinos that he got this personal prejudice against Native people, seemingly based largely on that, and that seems to have rebounded in him actually unilaterally revoking the Wampanoag's status. Is that right?
They took land out of trust, and so that is seen as sort of the path to termination of a tribe. There's this thing, this ruling that basically said that any tribes that were recognized after the Indian Reorganization Act in the 1930s didn't qualify to have land put into trust. And so tribes that were terminated or tribes that were not recognized yet, like the Wampanoag, they then used that to pull recognition, to pull land into trust, which would allow them to use that land to build casinos on. And so so that's what happened there. And there's a constant call for a fix for that carcerary fix for that particular ruling, and so that it doesn't impact tribes that way. So, that's still hasn't passed Congress yet. So,
okay,
yeah.
And they're in Massachusetts, right?
Yeah, it is seen as a threat, and we are looking. We did cover that a bit during I think during Friday's show, but we did go into that a bit. We will do more. I've been talking to folks there with the Wampanoag tribe. They are looking for more support to challenge this, and they feel, I'm not going to speak out of turn, but I think they feel like there hasn't been enough support, particularly from Indian country. But it may be that once again the Trump administration is using this opportunity to push forward on very conservative policies under the cover of the epidemic or the pandemic.
And of course, he's been doing that across the board. She's been doing up to this point all along is massive deregulation. But he's using the pandemic to push it even more on the whole automobile mileage standards. I believe a coal plant. Countries don't have to report pollution releases across the board. It's just mind-boggling. And so you want to talk a little bit more? Are there other instances in Indian country where actions are being taken like that?
Yeah. So on Friday, our episode will be focusing particularly on one of our. Often I have a co-host, and usually it's an editor at Pollination Magazine. And so on Wednesday, we have our co-host is going to be today. Our co-host is going to be Desiree Kane, who's a Miwok journalist based in Colorado. And one of the reasons we asked her to come on and co-host is because she's looking at the eviction issues there. And so she's been sort of a leader in fighting against, basically proposing a rent strike, right? And eviction is a problem for Native parents, urban and reservation. And so Friday, we are going to be looking at the how the Trump administration is using COVID-19 as cover to plunder tribal resources. And Mark Gadigan, who is a journalist in Northern California, who does a lot of work on Native issues there and is also an editor at Pollination, we're looking particularly at how it's impacting California, you know, water resources for tribes. And we'll be doing further episodes that look at other aspects of it.
Mm-hmm. And again, the number to call in is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I'm Paul Rowland. I'm speaking with Jacqueline Keeler. We're talking largely about the effect of the COVID-19 pandemic in Indian country. And any again, it, so you talk. I mean, maybe you would, I don't know. You want to focus obviously on these things that you're covering in your podcast. Are you have any observations about what you see in around you and in Oregon?
Yeah. So we are looking at more issues, but basically we're looking at more at the national scale, and we're bringing in local voices to speak to it, to kind of give the podcast a look nationally at Native issues and how Native communities are dealing with it. We will have on April 17th, a week from this Friday, we will be doing an episode on traditional stories of survivance in the era of coronavirus. And so we will, my co-host will be Emily Washeen. She's a Yakum historian and MIW activist. And so we'll be looking particularly at using tradition. And I think that we've seen this a lot on social media in Indian country. There are a number of Facebook groups that have been created. Probably the largest one is the Social Distancing Powwow, which has huge numbers of members. And it started out sharing videos of powwow dancers, particularly jingle dress dancers. And the jingle dress is, if your listeners aren't familiar with the powwows, but the jingle dress is a type of dress that actually came out as a form of medicine, as from a vision that a young Ojibwe woman, Anishinaabe woman had, and it's covered in little bells, and so they or jingles, I guess, and so they dance, and a dance is a prayer for healing, and so different jingle dress dancers in Canada and the United States were doing little bit short videos, and so this became the Social Distancing Powwow Facebook group became a place where they could share those videos. And now it's sort of grown to also support vendors, a lot of Native people. I know that on the Navajo Nation, I think the per estimate is as much as 30% of the income for families comes from being vendors, selling jewelry and art. And so it's a huge part of the economy. So for Native folks to not be able to get out and sell their work at events like powwows it has a huge impact on their ability to provide for their families. So they
the importance, the social importance of powwows and other events. I was again listening to another radio station talk about, I think they had like a rabbi and a Christian pastor, and you know, we're coming up on high season for all three of the Abrahamic faiths, if that's how you say it. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all have major spring celebrations that all are going to be severely impacted. And same thing in Indian country, right? I know the traditional spring feasts are coming up, and there's always powwows, you know, regularly going on throughout the year. That's a major impact.
Yeah, it's not being. Yeah, these are a pretty big deal. So we'll be covering that for next Friday, a week from Friday. This Monday, we're going to be looking at coronavirus in the prison system, and the threat that it poses to our incarcerated relatives. And so we'll be having we have invited a few former Standing Rock water protectors who have served time in federal prison for protesting, and to kind of get caught up on what the conditions are. So we're looking at getting Little Feather, and he, when he was incarcerated, he had issues with getting access to traditional medicine. I was pretty surprised. I visited him up in the Rugby Correction Center in North Dakota while he was being held there. He and Red Fawn Palace were both being held there. And I was really shocked that in North Dakota, which has such a substantial Native population and traditional elders and practitioners all around that facility, that they were unable to get access to sweat lodges and things that are available in other prisons across the country. And so so we'll speak to them about how this may impact transmission of the disease, the kind of health care available to prisoners, which is not great. There have been prisons where, where the coronavirus is being passed around within the prison system. In other countries, there have been actually riots, I believe, in Italy. Protests against how the prisoners are being treated. So they're a very vulnerable population. So we're going to, and many Native people are incarcerated at a much higher rate than other folks. I think four times the rate, even for Native women, the rate is several times that of non-Native women in the country. And so so their safety is important as well in this crisis. And then on Wednesday, we will be looking at staying at home without water and with at-risk relatives. And I will be inviting my cousin Lisa Robbins, who was featured in the LA Times article that I mentioned earlier, and her I can read a little bit from the article. The title of the article is "No Running Water, No Electricity on Navajo Nation: Coronavirus Creates Worry and Confusion as Cases Surge." The story featured one of my own family members, Shanna Yazzie and Lisa Robbins, both living in Cameron, Arizona, on the Navajo Nation near the south rim of the Grand Canyon. And at that point, when the article came out, the Grand Canyon was still open, so people said it was attracting people to the area. I mentioned how I enjoy the article, but it's still discouraging because it's kind of shocking that there's still news that so many people in the Navajo Nation don't have electricity and running water. And I worked as a community organizer on the Navajo Nation, and I actually lobbied for bills in the New Mexico State Legislature to bring electricity to different Navajo communities, we got them passed, and the governor at the time basically scuttled them. So here's a quote from the article. Robbins first started hearing the whispers earlier this month. The fever, that sickness, something called coronavirus. But most people in this town of about 900 didn't seem too worried. It was far off, neighbors told her, a world away in the big cities. So Robbins, who rarely has access to the internet or TV news, continued with her daily routine, which includes helping her mother, who sometimes suffers from side effects of a surgery years ago to remove a cancer stomach tumor. Then came the bang on her door and a stark warning from local leaders. They told us to stay inside, don't come out, because people could die, Robin said one evening last week. It hit us so fast, no one knows what to do. For Robin, 21, news of the devastating new virus has triggered a heightened sense of anxiety. She worries for her mother and her own weakened immune system, the result of having been born without a thyroid. And she worries, too, for so many other friends and loved ones here on the reservation who also have some underlying health condition. Then add this coronavirus, she said, we are scared. And then he also interviewed Shanna Yazzie, my other cousin, and he says, Shanna Yazzie, a Cameron resident, has no running water or electricity. A wood-burning stove heats the living room of the home she shares with her mother and two children. At least once a month, Yazzie visits family and takes her children to orthodontist appointments in Phoenix, about 200 miles south, and stocks up on supplies at Costco. In early March, she made the trek and was stunned by the crowds at the store. That's when I realized something was up and this was bad, Yazzie recalled, adding that initially she heard some people on the reservation joking that Navajo Natives couldn't get the coronavirus. And the outbreak of the virus on the Navajo Nation is believed to have started at an evangelical church rally in Tilchinbeto, Arizona, on March 7th. And so the Navajo Nation declared a state of emergency on the 13th of March, and then 1 week later, on March 20th, issued a reservation-wide shelter-in-place order for all residents. And they have since actually, further orders have they're policing now, and they've issued a complete shutdown for the weekend.
So how would you like to, we only have about 10 minutes left, how would you like to possibly transition into talking a little bit about one of the subjects of your upcoming book, Standoff. And I wanted to transition into it. There's a really interesting book. I mean, this thing is really forcing us. It's basically exploding, you know, all the contradictions of our economy, our society, our culture, and you know, who's going to end up, you know, ultimately winning the battle. I unfortunately am, you know, I guess somewhat pessimistic, and it seems like the rich and powerful and wealthy do tend to win out, you know, using these things as kind of a shock doctrine, as Naomi Klein says. But we do have the opportunity, as things are really shaking up, to possibly challenge some of these deep-seated delusions, as this article, coronavirus is forcing the GOP to, parentheses, tacitly admit its ideology is delusional. And three delusional things. And the third one is the second one is Uncle Sam has grown badly bloated and could govern more effectively if a wide swath of federal agencies were gutted. Three, the market is a largely apolitical sphere ruled by the impartial dictates of an invisible hand. Anyway, but it seems like one of the people who are really carrying that to extreme are the Bundys, and that's something that you've covered in your thing. And in Idaho, they're threatening to undermine the orders to stay in place by gathering, saying that their liberty is threatened by this, which a lot of evangelical pastors are doing around the country, and flouting these orders and having large assemblies in church and basically praying for the blood of Jesus to bathe them and protect them, as a lot of people are saying. Anyway, you want to talk about the Bundy rebellion, the continuation of the Bundy rebellion in Idaho?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Ever since this has been going on, I've been sort of following it and trying to I was wondering what was going to happen, because if you have an order that's being enforced to stay at home, and you have a group of folks who are not very inclined to scientific reasoning, it sort of seems to be an explosive mixture. And of course, when I start checking Ammon Bundy's social media feeds, I immediately came across that he was definitely posting. Well, he actually held a meeting he owns a warehouse in Idaho. I don't know if people know this, but he used to live when his father did the 2014 standoff with the BLM in Bunkerville, Nevada. He was living in the Phoenix, Arizona area, running a trucking repair maintenance fleet outfit, which, if you look up their reviews on Yelp, they were like, had very low reviews. They were not considered very dependable. And he'd gotten a $500,000 Small Business Administration loan to basically set up shop. At some point he sold that, and he moved up to Idaho, and now lives in a place that used to be the Republican. I don't know what's going on with his finances exactly, but the his residence used to be where the Republican Party had their offices.
Interesting.
Yeah, the former state representative from there came down and joined his, very, very supportive of his work, and spoke out in Congress in support. And so it does seem like he's getting some kind of financial or some sort of support from political powers in Idaho, right? Right-wing, conservative, Republican, largely Mormon folks are helping to underwrite his lifestyle.
Which, of course, they got a lot of that kind of support during the standoff at the Malheur Refuge.
Yeah, he lives in a home that his neighbors are like the governor of Idaho, you know, just outside of Boise. And so it's only actually, if you look on the map, it's just an hour due east from Burns, Oregon. So it wasn't that far for him to travel, across the border and to do the whole thing at Malheur. And far closer than it is from Portland, Oregon, where it's like a 5-hour drive down to Burns, Oregon. And so, so anyway, he in addition to owning this property, this home next to a governor of Idaho, he also owns a warehouse in Boise or in Emmett, I think. And he so he held a meeting there in defiance of the governor's orders to not hold meetings over a certain number. And basically declared that if they that he would basically they would come with guns. He made everyone there sign a pledge that they would come with guns and everything to basically defend the right of someone to defy the stay-at-home order.
It says in this article, Mr. Bundy said in an interview that a group in the Boise area was looking for a venue to host an Easter service this coming weekend with a potential crowd of 1,000 people. I mean, good luck. I doubt it'll get that many. But said a man in Twin Falls hoped to host communion in a park. And Mr. Bundy himself is now leading regular meetings with dozens of people to assess how to fight back against what he calls government overreach, including with a physical presence if necessary. It's interesting, though, that, you know, this is a, I mean, in a sense, he's going against the Trump administration. In a sense, there seems to be some sort of, I hate to use this term that way, but it's a sort of schizoid in a way. I don't know. What do you make of that?
Well, I actually think it's consistent. In a sense that so in my book Stand Up, I did a lot of research on, you know, his family's philosophical history, and it's it really, you know, the idea that they definitely have the idea that that they're basically, that the federal and powers have no, that they have these rights of freedom of movement, of action, and that they can make a choice to stay at home if they choose to. But the actual enforcement of it is the line in the sand. Do you know what I mean? So it's that they have, you know, police officers and stuff like that challenging people and making them go home or issuing fines. And I think here in even Oregon, the governor issued a thing where it's a misdemeanor if the business were to be open this time, you know. And so those kinds of things are what they're challenging, is this sort of enforcement aspect of it. So he actually, he's been looking for another way to push this forward more. This is the same sort of thing that the Trump administration and different other right-wing think tanks are using, disaster capitalism to push forward things that they've already have, you know, thought out, quite, you know, policies that they have ready to go, right? Whether it means, you know, gutting the EPA further, you know, I think completely at this point, right? I mean, the EPA is basically non-functioning now, or even in Canada, watching Canada dump $1 billion into what is now what used to be called TransCanada to be able to restart the Keystone XL pipeline. You know, there's all these ways in which, these folks are basically using this as an opportunity. And Bundy, you know, is always looking for an opportunity. I mean, even in the fall, he went and, challenged the eviction of a family from their ranch and stuff, and gathered a whole group of people and went over there. But then he backed off because he claimed he looked at the actual paperwork and felt like it was done right or something. But in this case, you know, he's fighting another opportunity to be able to push forward his agenda on a national level. And so so it's basically he's facing off with the governor of Idaho, who has issued this order. And it's consistent philosophically, I would say. And I'm not to say that I think it's correct at all, But, you know, he claims that there's nothing about public health in the Constitution, and he wants to lead a national movement to defy stay-at-home orders. You know, I saw this coming, you know, and so it's and actually my book Standoff, because of the coronavirus epidemic, the distributors have delayed the publishing. And so
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, so I actually have a couple more. I think I'm going with the couple more months I have at my disposal, I think I'm going to really follow this whole thing of him trying to create another Standoff in the midst of a pandemic, and try to probably rewrite the last few chapters to include that aspect of it. It's philosophical.
Let no crisis go to waste, as they say. I'm just kidding.
Well, you know, it's sort of a it's a manifestation of and when in Standoff, if your listeners don't know, I actually compare to the two Standoffs I covered as a journalist in 2016, the Bundy's takeover of Malheur here in Oregon, the wildlife refuge. And also and Standing Rock, what happened at Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so I compare the two, and I did a lot of work and research on looking at the socio political sort of origins of each perspective. And myself, I am Dakota. My family, my father's family, are Yankton Sioux. And we've had a long-term connection with the people of Standing Rock. My grandmother's grandparents served there as Episcopal priest and wife for 40 years. And so you know, historically, of course, as being Dakota and Lakota, we are one people, and we are and signed a treaty with the United States called the Great, in which we were entitled the Great Sioux Nation.
We better wrap up.
Oh, sorry. So anyway, I do love comparing them, and it's interesting now seeing in the present moment in this crisis how each group reacts, and you see that the Native communities really drawing together to enforce the stay-at-home order, working together as a community to preserve each other, recognizing the importance of protecting our elders, our cultural carriers, are everyone. And then you compare this to what the Bundys are doing and where their philosophy and their outlook leads them,
which is sort of the hardest of the hardcore of American frontier ethic.